Chris Gebhardt, NASA Space Flight, thank you so much for joining me. Thanks for being willing to break this down, and thanks for being here.
My pleasure. It's good to be here.
We started talking about this a couple weeks ago. I was thinking about who am I going to talk with about the Elon Musk presentation, and I couldn't think of anyone better except the person who Elon Musk himself, you'll have to remind me what mission this was, commented on how well you have the details down when you were asking him a question. That was like a couple months ago, right?
I think that was the first Falcon 9 booster reflight.
Yeah, that's right.
Back at the end of May, yeah.
So that came to my mind. I was like, well, I think if this is ordained by Elon Musk himself, let's go for it. So let's give some thoughts on the general event. You know, what was your main takeaway from the presentation itself? And what things did you find most interesting out of it?
I think the thing I found most interesting, which I'm sure took almost everyone by surprise, was BFR as the point-to-point transport for Earth. I'm not sure anyone really saw that coming, but it was certainly a nice surprise to see in terms of SpaceX thinking about how this technology and what we've seen in the development with Falcon 9 propulsive landings over the last few years, how that technology is useful to us here on Earth, because that's sort of the age-old question, right? Like, we see the missions launch, we see the satellites go up, and if it's not a GPS satellite that you can complain about that your navigation system isn't working on your phone or it takes you down road A instead of road B, right? That age-old question is really, well, what benefit do I get here on Earth? And it was really good to see SpaceX thinking about how the BFR technology can do that and how it could potentially help to really start a conversation about what air traffic is, how air traffic control works, because obviously that's a huge part of, you know, BFR as basically a plane. So it was really good to see that conversation begin and to have that put out there for what it could do for our connectivity and our travel.
I found that really interesting because of, save for maybe the Mars City, the hypothetical Mars City you showed, of all the things he talked about, that is probably the most long-term vision of BFR itself, because that doesn't really come into fruition until BFR is flying regularly, reliably, on a giant scale with plenty of ships to be had, you know, well into the production of it. But like you're saying, that is something that if it is a vision of this thing, they do need to get that conversation started earlier because of everything else that it's related to. Whereas, you know,
right,
when you're looking at BFR as a single moon mission lander or sending a couple to Mars, you know, there's obviously a lot of stuff to get through there, red tape and whatnot, that you have to build launch infrastructure and do everything like that. But it is not a worldwide infrastructure issue. It is localized on Earth, political in the country in which you're launching from. But beyond that, it's not something that is such a massive scale like, you know, flying these around the world would be. So I had some conflicted feelings on that.
Yeah. And, you know, I think in a large way, you're right. You know, there's a huge difference between using the BFR architecture for establishment and servicing of lunar bases and the Mars architecture, which we'll delve into soon. I guess people probably were surprised that we started with BFR as a plane instead of everything it can do for space exploration. But it is different, right? Because there, you know, what you're worried about in terms of BFR launches for the lunar architecture and for the Mars architecture don't include major public safety concerns, right? The Cape is very isolated. It launches out over water. You know, the BFR as a plane is really talking about overflight of land and a huge structural change and operational change to what air traffic control would be. So, you know, those conversations are necessary. Those conversations about how air traffic control will revolutionize are already occurring, right? And how we can integrate technology and real-time tracking, especially over the oceans, into this. But yeah, there are going to be safety concerns. There are going to be national and militaristic concerns with BFR. And you're right. It obviously has to, there have to be hundreds, if not thousands, of these things, right? Probably hundreds. Thousands is a bit of an exaggeration. But, you know, there have to be hundreds of these things already produced and already flying. And the technology really has to be proven in a far more concrete way than, you know, what we saw with the FAA in 2015. Allowing SpaceX to come back and land their first successful landing of the Falcon 9 booster on land, right? There hadn't been any successful landings up to that point. But again, the Cape is so isolated that if there had been a problem, it wouldn't have been a safety risk to people. Yeah, right. So
like, the biggest impact was that like it woke people up in the middle of the night. And even then, yes. It's like, okay, big deal. I remember the shuttle flying over Florida back in the day. It was much louder than that particular incident.
Exactly. But these conversations are necessary. You know, and we were talking a little bit before the show, right, about, you know, we're recording this on the 60th anniversary of the Sputnik launch and the beginning of the space era. And, you know, Sputnik was ambitious and Sputnik was a huge technical challenge. There were major legal questions about was it a violation of international law to launch a satellite into orbit that would go over another country, right? And all of these conversations eventually played out, right? All of the technical challenges that spaceflight has are met in one way or another, but you have to have that ambition, you have to have that drive, and you have to start those conversations early in order to, you know, make the future and science fiction a reality, which, as I'm very fond of saying, SpaceX has a way of taking the impossible and making it a reality. So, you know, we'll see where we get with that. But that was the thing that really shocked me most about BFR, and shocked me in a good way.
Yeah, I could tell from your tweets and all that you were pretty pumped. And I would get emails in our email thread like, what the hell is going on? And, you know, freaking out about this. So it was pretty funny to see everyone's reaction.
Indeed.
So like I said, that was kind of the most long-term vision, though I think a lot of people took it as a nearer-term vision because it's Earth, after all. And they see Mars cities and stuff like that, and they think, okay, well, the Mars stuff is the stuff that's really far away, timeline-wise. And much like, if you remember back to the last year's presentation, the end of it, he ended on a note about, you know, Europa landers and going out to Saturn and things like that. And I was kind of annoyed at that because I felt like it took his message that was, this is an architecture that's here and now, we are building it, we've got a tank, we've got an engine. It took that message of, we are working on this now, and it put it on a time scale that most people could, you know, kind of say, ah, that'll happen someday, or it'll fall apart before it gets there. Mm-hmm. Kind of wave it off because of that long-term nature. And I had a similar feeling with the point-to-point thing, in that, you know, if the difference between last year and this year was, let's scale back some of this stuff, both in size and in development costs, so that we can do it on the same or similar time scale, that we can achieve what we want. But the end of it then threw everyone for a trip, and it kind of distracted from that message again. I thought personally that it distracted from the core message, because, you know, he came out on stage and the first thing he said was, the thing I want to convey this year is that we figured out how to pay for it. And at no point in the presentation did he specifically comment on the paying for it. It was through implication of, we've downscaled, so development costs less, or look at how we would service the ISS for that, which you and I and everyone listening, they pick up on the fact that, oh, well, that's their current contracts that they're working on, and they're going to still do the things that they're doing now to make money to fund this. But to somebody just watching from the outside, I don't think that implication really would hit home, that that is their business model, and that is how they're going to pay for it, is that they're going to take this system and do the things they're doing today, but shift everyone to this new architecture. So I was a little bummed that it kind of distracted from that main point, which I'm not expecting, you know, the general TV news stuff to cover like a full on SpaceX business plan in review of that. So that's probably a little stupid of me to say in general, but that was kind of my takeaway at the end, the thing I was left with.
I mean, and I can see that. You know, I think one of the struggles a lot of us and a lot of people have with how this information rolls out, right, is we are still so used to the NASA model of communication, right, where you get all these little incremental updates. I mean, how to put it in perspective, right, how many updates have we seen from NASA and Orbital ATK about the solid rocket boosters for the SLS missions, right? Like, we know they're casting the boosters for EM2. We know the boosters for EM1 have been cast, and they're in, you know, they're doing the photogrammetry, you know, painting on them right now. And you get those little incremental steps all the way, right? Because the government has to be accountable for that, right? So, you know, we're all still trying to adapt, I think, to this, to the new model of, you know, SpaceX is a private company and they don't technically have to tell us anything, right? It's in their interest to tell us things, but they don't have to.
Yeah, especially like consider the difference that you're talking about here. How many times we heard about SLS engine tests? Mm-hmm. And all of a sudden we find out there's been over 40 Raptor engine firings.
Right. Which, you know, this is the benefit of having people out near McGregor, where, you know, you can hear like, wait a minute, there was a huge rumble at McGregor. I don't know. Was it a Falcon? Was it a Raptor? You know, these sort of, you know, yearly updates on the architecture in ways can seem kind of jarring when major elements change. Now, one thing I was fascinated by in the presentation was just almost how much the plan has not changed. You know, there was the, you know, what is now a very logical addition of like, well, hey, if it can go to Mars, it can certainly go to the moon, you know? But, you know, these yearly presentations, you know, to speak to your point about how they've ended the last 2 years, you know, when it's your main method of getting across everything this system can do, you know, I think in a way it's very hard to structure a presentation in any way where the takeaway wouldn't be like, oh my gosh, it's going to be a, you know, it's going to be like a big plane and you can get to Sydney from New York in 45 minutes. You know, I guess my feeling on that personally was whether that had been the opening of the presentation, the middle of it, or the end, I still think it would have been the thing people would have walked away immediately wanting to talk about, right? Because, you know, even Musk admitted that, you know, the 2022 and 2024 for the first six BFR missions to Mars is ambitious. You know, now, what I found fascinating by that is that in the last year, though, that date has not changed. You know, I was certainly expecting to already be talking about, you know, okay, well, maybe it slipped a couple of years, maybe it slipped to the next window. And you know, I think everyone walked away from that with a realistic view that, you know, okay, it's going to slip, right? So there were the technical sides of it that everyone was like, okay, we've got to give this more time to shake out. You know, exciting that they're going to be start production on the first BFR next year. You know, that certainly makes a 2022 timeline possible if you start building in 2018, especially with the composite materials that they're using and all the testing that they've done with the Falcons. You know, rocketry is hard, but the less complicated you make the system, right, the easier it can be to get by. So I think in terms of this feeling of is it a distraction, is it a, or is it just there wasn't any good place to put that in the presentation where, you know, people wouldn't have walked away saying, well, that's the tangible thing.
That's true. No, that's true. And if I guess I'm thinking now, if you were to take that out, the reaction might be like you said, so little has changed. Why are you even here telling us about this? You know, because obviously The downscaling happened and that's like making it more realistic. And the only other change would have been, all right, so you're like cool with moon bases. You know, that would have been the takeaway.
Yeah. Yeah. It's making it a bit more realistic. It definitely makes it, you know, because my main thought last year with BFR, when they were like, oh yeah, it's going to have 28 million pounds of thrust at liftoff. And my first thought was like, well, which launch pad are you going from? You know, 28 million pounds is like the upper limit of what 39A and 39B at Kennedy can withstand. So, you know, the scale back makes it more realistic in terms of the existing architecture that's present, right? Because if you were also talking about this system needing to have a completely new pad or really radically alter the pads at Kennedy, you'd have a major problem with that 2022 timeline.
Yeah, definitely.
Now, the pads have to be modified anyway.
I'm wondering, though, we've heard, you know, like fits and starts of Boca Chica news. And I'm starting to wonder if they're just, you know, given the changes in their workflow that maybe we can touch on in a couple minutes, are they going to just go full in on Boca Chica being the launch pad for BFR and starting there and keeping Kennedy and Canaveral and Vandenberg as untouched as possible? Or do you think that they would say that the first launch is out of Cape Canaveral?
I think the first launch is going to be out of Cape Canaveral. You know, Boca Chica is definitely, per their plans, it's definitely a base that they have looked at, right, for launching BFR. The launch angles and the launch azimuths that you have to use out of Boca Chica are very limiting, because you can't overfly the Yucatan, you can't overfly the Caribbean islands.
There's one lane basically to fly.
There's one lane, and you really have to thread that 90-mile gap between the end of Florida and the top of Cuba.
And all of the oil platforms that are out in the Gulf and stuff.
Yeah, exactly. So, you know, Boca Chica has its uses, and that is not to say that BFR cannot launch from there, right? But, you know, the way I look at it is, you know, look, you've got a rocket that can launch from 39A or 39B, right? That's well within what those pads can withstand. We know Florida's land can withstand the thrust profile of a BFR, right? If you've got the pad, if you've got the propellant tanks already there, right, and you're talking about adding some more propellant lines and a new launch mount and building a new hangar, that's a lot easier than trying to do all of that and build the pad at Boca Chica from scratch. So I think definitely BFR goes first from the Florida facilities. And you know, what you were talking about too, in terms of like the what's changed, you know, yeah, there's a scaled back version that makes it more economical, that makes it more, you know, almost for lack of a better word, doable. That I think you're right. You know, there's an element to these presentations where you also have to capture the public imagination, right? And you have to make this system, especially for what SpaceX's larger plans are, right, of lower cost access to space, right? But, you know, $500,000 price tag to be one of those colonists, if that still is what the price tag is, right? You know, I don't have that lying around in the bank account. I'm pretty sure most people don't. But, you know, the thing I really took away, and I think one reason why BFR as point-to-point transport on Earth was included specifically at the end of the presentation, which Musk admitted after the fact he forgot to talk about the price point for that, but afterward in an Instagram post he did, you know, when he's talking about using BFR as a plane and a ticket on it would be full fare economy. I mean, full fare economy, not full fare first class, full fare economy on that. That really does begin to touch on what the potential price points and what the benefits of reuse are, right? Where you can make, I think the figure, oh boy, correct me if I'm wrong, the figure last year was that the BFRs would be reusable 1,000 times?
The boost stage was 1,000, tanker was something like that. And I think the ship number was way low, but that was counting, you know, the years that you spend at Mars and things like that.
Right. So, you know, if you're talking about 1,000 reuses of that as a baseline, you know, I think the reason that was included in the presentation was to really hone in on, no, we can do this cheaply, right? We can do this in a very economical way. And, you know, you can kind of start to translate that out a little bit to, okay, well, then if I wanted to go to the moon for the weekend, right, or for a couple weeks, what would that cost? If New York to Sydney is, you know, maybe a little liberally speaking, a $350 ticket, you know, okay, well, then what's the moon? Well, then what's Mars? You know, it starts to put it on a scale where people can get excited and understand what the benefits and what the price points are in terms of everyday life.
Yeah. I like that. You might have changed my mind on that section a little bit. Let's get into some of the hardware stuff. Just a couple things I want to talk about, mostly just Raptor and the tank. Mm-hmm. I have been having a hard time finding out exactly what the deal is. Based on all the available info I have, the Raptor specs stated in the presentation are either extremely close to or the same as the Raptor on the stand in McGregor. Is that true? Am I off on based on that? I don't really know the exact details there. What it felt like was that they maybe have done all this testing and figured out what they can get out of something that size and settled in upon it. Because I believe that the diameter of the nozzles is decreased because they're packing 31 in the new boost stage and the old geometry wouldn't fit in that booster. So they downscaled the size at least a little bit. I don't know how that maps up to the one on the stand. Because if so, that's kind of big.
Yeah. That's an excellent question. A lot of the testing that goes on at McGregor and what those test stands are, I mean, are really, until we get any form of confirmation, just our best guesses. I know some of the more recent ones before. So I know the most recent round of testing that ended in September was the end of one of their test phases completely, and that they were moving on to a new phase. I know there's a lot of speculation that the various test bays, especially the new one that we've been watching them build, because McGregor isn't that controlled of a facility, so you can fly a Cessna pretty close to it and take pictures, and it's totally legal to do that.
This is some call out for the L2ians out there that are also looking at these photos.
And a shout out to our L2 people who do this. Yes, I know from what we can see there are differences in the test stands. We definitely know that the test stand that's been operational is what's been termed the subscale Raptor. How subscale that is from the Raptor that they're talking about that will actually be on BFR is kind of a guess at this point. Until we have the specifics of what the subscale Raptors that they've been testing are actually capable of producing in terms of their thrust and their power, we really don't have a way to know. And this speaks back to what we were talking about earlier, that, you know, SpaceX can be a little secretive in what goes on because they're a private company. So it's an excellent question. I wish I knew the answer to it. I'm not sure anyone outside of SpaceX does.
I can't find anyone really talking about this aside from just conjecture, in the SpaceX subreddit and stuff like that. But if that is the case, that they determined the scale that they were using previously in testing will work out for this thing, and what they've been testing for the past, what has it been, a year and a half or so, is the Raptor that's going to fly. That's a pretty big deal that I don't think, that might be the biggest news out of this event itself, is that they've been testing Raptor for the last year.
And it very well could be that they've either been testing, exactly what the Raptor will be, or a very, very close version. It's been a while in the public eye, right, since we have seen with this much interest, right, the development of these kinds of engines, right, and how you play with different configurations, how you play with different nozzles, for optimization. So it's possible that that what this testing showed them as they moved through the optimization of the system is that they were very close, if not, almost right on target for what they needed for what BFR evolved into, right?
Emerging of plans here is that they have these plans going for this rocket, they have this plans going for the launch vehicle, and those might have started to get closer together over the past year when somebody realized, hey, the size that we're working with, could match up. Now, I would love to have any confirmation on that. We're not going to get any confirmation on that for quite a while, I would assume.
I would assume that as well, yes.
So the other hardware...
But it is worth noting, right? Because just real quickly, that a lot of... because McGregor is so isolated and we don't see a lot of the testing that goes on there because it's not California, it's not Florida, right? it's pretty isolated area of Texas, that the Raptor testing has been very ambitious and quite continuous over the last year. You know, they test fired the first Raptor right before the big announcement of BFR last year. And they have had numerous firings and testings of that engine. So it is a very robust test program that's going on.
Nearly 1 a week based on the numbers that we saw.
Yeah, almost 1 a week. And we know that they're moving into the next phase of testing. We don't know exactly what that means, but we know that, you know, sometime this month they should be into the new phase of testing for Raptor. So that's worth noting that it's very robust.
Yeah, and any good launch vehicle is built on its engines. So that's definitely the most important piece to get out of the front, right? So
yes, indeed.
The other one is the tank, which we finally, much to all of our enjoyment, got a video of the bursting of that tank. Mm-hmm. We had seen the photos of the debris that came back from the at-sea testing they did. They said that it bursted past design strength.
Yes.
Though I believe that test was done with nitrogen inside, so there's still the, obviously they didn't use liquid oxygen out there, that would have been a little bit more ferocious of an explosion. So that seems to me, you know, they've had this 12-meter tank, they tested it, it worked to their standards that they needed that tank to work. They are downscaling to 9 meters, which should bring some additional strength to it since it is a smaller structure. The biggest dragon there to slay, no pun intended, I guess, is dealing with liquid oxygen, which, you know, historically the guidance is don't mix liquid oxygen and composite. So could that be the next phase of testing for them, is building one of these tanks with the tooling they've got? They validated the tooling works. They wanted to order the tooling for that 9 meter size. Now they can build some test tanks to go in and actually use propellants on these tanks that they would build.
I think given their history with locks and composites, there definitely will be some form of testing, right? I mean, any rocket development system, right? You always build test articles. You always build the elements that will actually be, you know, loaded with propellant and tested on stands before, you know, you put the vehicle on the pad and before you fuel it and light the engines. Exactly what that testing is going to be, you know, I think is largely in a way determined by what SpaceX learned and what changes they made to the Falcon 9s after the Amos 6 incident last year. You know, we don't know entirely everything that was done. We know they tested, we know they fueled and tested a lot of composite pressure overwrap vessels with locks in them and tested them to failure, trying to replicate the problem that led to the Amos 6 loss on the pad. Will they actually do that with a tank the size of BFR? Maybe. you know, but an important thing to note with this too is that with all of the testing that they did before they returned to flight after Amos 6, they also gathered an incredible amount of engineering data on how LOX interacts with those composites. And if I were a betting man, I would venture to guess that there's something on the Falcon 9s now that also gives them that information, right? So they're continually monitoring that.
Man, that is, I didn't even consider that in one bit, and that is like so, that's such like a fate story. Like, hey, there's gonna be a giant composite LOX problem right when you're talking about using giant composites with a lot of LOX last year. And so if that is like something that comes out in the future, that hey, Amos 6 was maybe the shittiest day to ever work at SpaceX, but look at what it made us do back then. Look at how good at LOX and composites we are now. And if that contributes in a major way to BFR, that's what a way to turn a victory or turn a defeat into a victory in some sort.
Yeah. And you know, like, you know, there's the, you know, there's this, it's not a rule, but, you know, in rocket flight and in rocketry, you know, you're going to have failures, and we know that, right? But the key is really to not have the same failure twice, right? To learn from that. And, you know, I don't think anyone in any business is keen on repeating a failure and saying, oh, I guess we didn't learn from that, right? So you know, like I said, it's not confirmed. This is just me saying, like, if I'm a betting man, like I would assume that there is some sensor system on the Falcon 9s now that monitor this as we go through each launch. So the whole point of that is really to say, like, you know, the decision that's going to have to be made is, do you model the LOX tank, right, and its composites computer, you know, with computer analytics, and because of everything you've learned, and do you determine that that is enough, or do you want to actually do real world testing those components to failure again? You know, I think it's a testament for what we heard last week that, you know, when they tested the LOX tank article for BFR to failure, it failed past the design, you know, specs of what they actually needed. So that speaks in a lot of ways to the robust elements of the system that they're designing.
Yeah, that was a very encouraging portion. Hardware-wise, I don't think there was anything too much else to really comment on other than the fact that they haven't figured out what to do with landing legs. They're in some graphics. They're not in other graphics. Those are still way up in the air.
Yeah. You know, Musk talked a lot about the need for precision landing and perfecting that element of it. And I think, you know, a lot of us who follow every single Falcon 9 launch, and for those of us who don't, this is, you know, how many missions do we comment on, like, man, like, that was almost dead center on the X, you know, yeah, on the barge. And, you know, I think a lot of us have just been like, wow, look at how accurate they were. Maybe not consciously realizing that that was on purpose, right?
Yeah, exactly.
And exactly how close to the dead center.
That they're aiming for a point, not a barge.
Not the pad, right. Exactly.
They're aiming for a point, and they're hitting it. I think the last one was within 0.7 meters of where they were aiming. So, like,
it's something ridiculously
incredible.
Close. Yeah, and when
and that was the booster that went the highest.
Yeah, and when you're
crazy.
Accounting for, like, wind shear, you know, and all of that as the rocket is in real time, you know, trying to hit this pinpoint target, it's, you know, 0.7 meters is damn impressive.
Yeah,
to make. You know, I think a lot of us have been looking at those, you know, at that precision, you know, gearing up for what we're going to see, hopefully at the end of this year, maybe a little more realistically the beginning of next year, when Falcon 9 when Falcon Heavy takes to the sky, and watching two boosters fly back in formation meters from each other,
yeah,
you know,
yeah.
And have to do this choreographed landing sequence. I think that's what we were all really looking at in that precision. But then to note what Musk was saying with BFR and why, you know, the most recent renderings for it do not have landing legs is because they want to do away with that. They want it to be able to come back and do something that, technically speaking, is incredibly challenging, you know, to come back and land on its launch mount. And we won't go into all the technicalities there, but, you know, needless to say, it's not just, you know, landing softly on the launch mount to the point where you don't damage it, right? It's landing in a very precise orientation where the rocket has to be aligned on its circumference perfectly, right? You can't have a 1-inch misalignment or a 1/2-inch misalignment when you're talking about the propellant feed lines going into the rocket. Those have to match perfectly. So, you know, when he talked about that, my initial thought wasn't, oh, they'll never be able to land on the launch mount, because I've learned to say never when it comes to SpaceX. You know, it was really my question then became, well, how close are the Falcon 9s coming to on their circumference, right, landing perfectly the way you want them? You know, how many degrees off of that ideal landing mark are they, especially when they come back to land on land? You know, the barge has its own set of, you know, it's usually windier out at sea, so
yeah,
they're having last
a lot
minute
of wave action.
Wave action, you know, that you don't get on land. So how close are they actually coming to that ability to land perfectly in the circumference, you know, perspective became my question.
Yeah. The ship part is curious. If that, you know, the only landing legs we saw on the ship were graphics of it on the moon or on Mars. Right. The other diagrams that we saw, which were much more early days design, which I actually appreciated that they didn't show this is the final product that you will see in 5 years. They kind of showed it as a work in progress that it is. Mm-hmm. The landing legs are still yet to be figured out on that. Obviously not a deal breaker or anything that I'm like, oh crap, what are they going to do with landing legs? They're building a crazy system that, you know, landing legs are the least of my worries in that regard. So I'm not too concerned about that, I guess, but.
So they are rather important when once you get to the moon.
Yes, you want them there, but I'm confident that they will be figured out when we need them.
Yeah, especially when you look at, you know, the landing legs on the Falcon 9s. You know, we haven't had major failures of the landing legs in a long time.
Jason 3 is probably the last one.
I mean, long time. I say that. I mean,
like
what?
2 years.
Literally, that's 2 years.
Yeah.
But man, it seems like a long time
it
ago.
It does.
Yeah, you know, the sort of incremental approach that they took and that they use every single time with landing leg deployment and the robustness of that system, I'm with you. Like, it's definitely a work in progress for BFR and in terms of the craft, the spacecraft itself, but I think you're right in terms of, like, that's the least of the developmental hurdles that have to be overcome here. Yeah.
One thing that I wanted to comment on real quick that I thought also was taken a little out of context, not even taken out of context, but maybe misconstrued and blown out of proportion, I would say, after the fact, that there's been a lot of talk about his comment about ending the Falcon and Dragon production lines and shifting to BFR. And I don't know why, but...
a gutsy move.
Yeah, and it is. It totally is. But there seems to be a lot of feeling that this is happening, like, next year or the year after. And I think that's totally overblown, that, you know, this isn't going to happen until they move from development to production of BFR. There's still the whole development phase that has to go on. And obviously, there's going to be a team working on producing the development ships up front. But just like, I think, you know, one good example here would be Dragon 1 and 2. Mm-hmm. The Dragon 1 production line is still around. It's not producing new ones. It's refurbishing old ones. But that's not going to shift over to be a full-on Dragon 2 production line until Dragon 2 is done being developed and it shifts into raw production mode. So there's a mindset shift that has to happen there. And I honestly cannot see, you know, based on the current schedules we're giving, this happening anytime until sometime in the 2020s. When you go from development phase of BFR into, we know what we're building, we know how we're building it, we've got all the specs worked out, this design checks out, it works, it flies. You don't want to go into production until you've figured out all of that stuff, because you don't want to be producing, you know, 5 ships that are multi-billion dollar ships that then all of a sudden you realize, oh crap, we have to rework some major component of it. So to me, that felt a little overblown, that people were like, oh crap, Falcon's going away next year. It's going to be around for, at this point, the better part of a decade until those production lines flip over. I don't know if you had any thoughts on the production line comments there.
I mean, overall, I think you're right. I think, you know, it was when he said that, it was definitely, and I referenced this in the article I wrote last week on this, which, you know, a couple years ago, I think almost everyone would have said, you're going to throw away your flight proven, like, I mean, and a reputation you earned with the Falcon 9 through a lot of hard work, right? You're going to just discontinue that because here comes BFR. But you're right, you know, this isn't, you know, the Falcon 9s are shutting down next year. In fact, one thing that, and you really had to be looking at the screen to catch this, because it was very fleeting, but there was a screen that talked about, that showed the progression of the number of Falcon flights each year, right? And the big ones that were highlighted were the ones from the past, from Falcon 1 through Falcon 9, and what they've done this year. with 13, I mean, 14 and 15 are slated to go here in within 2 days of each other. And, you know, with a mark of getting to 20 flights of the Falcon 9 this year. But there was a little gray bar right beyond that of what the projection for the Falcon 9 next year was. And it was over 30. They're talking about over 30 flights of Falcon 9 next year. So, you know, this isn't a, you know, it stops next year or it stops in 2019. And even Musk stated, we're going to keep Falcon 9 and Falcon Heavy around for our customers. You know, maybe BFR isn't the best option, right? Especially for government and national security launches, right? There's still a place for the Falcon 9 and the Falcon Heavy. But I think what is very different here in terms of what we're talking about, right, is this is not like what we're seeing with ULA, right, where their business model is as part of the transition to the Vulcan rocket, right? The Atlas V stays in all of its various configurations. The Delta IV only stays in the heavy configuration, right? And the Delta IV mediums are going to be phased out. In fact, right now, December is the scheduled last flight of the Delta IV medium in the 5-2 configuration out of Vandenberg, and then that variant is retired, right? That's not what we're seeing with SpaceX. What we're seeing is them saying, look, we have recovered 16 boosters in the last 16 times that we have tried this, right? They're going to reach a point where they have enough of the Block 4s, of the Block 5s, and even the Block 3s, right? Where you have enough that you can do your manifest and you can service all of the customers that are still wanting to fly on the Falcon 9, on the Falcon Heavy. And we can do all of that while not having to produce more, right? By just refurbishing the ones that we've got. And I think that was a very key point. Maybe that wasn't articulated, you know, as well as it could have been, but that's definitely what I came away with from thinking. Is my initial thought was like, what? You're stopping them? And then when I listened to it again, that's not what he was saying. He was saying production on them ceases. But I mean, heck, by that point, you might have 50.
Yeah, you could fly another 5-10 years, you know, with the amount of
60 of them sitting around, right? Especially with, you know, what we know of the Block 5 design being designed to fly 100 times each. Like, you've got a huge production scale. Now, stage two, you might need to keep the production line going on stage two, because as we know, the first Falcon Heavy flight might be the first time they attempt a recovery of the second stage. But we're a ways out from, you know, stage two recovery and reuse you know, what we see with the first stage. So,
but yeah, you're right. It is a shift from production to fleet management. It's maybe even a third step of what I was just talking about, where you go from development to production to fleet management. So if that's the case, like I was saying, you move one thing from development to production. When you move another from production to fleet management, another can come into production at that point. But it just seemed like everyone thought that was happening next year, and they were going to build 50 Falcon 9 cores in the next year, which is totally ridiculous anyway, and it's going to go away. So yes, that is going to happen, but it is going to take a few years from where we're even at now. And like you're saying, there's a lot of hardware yet to be flown with Block 5s and recoverable upper stages, if that really does come into fruition, and recoverable fairings for that matter, something that they're working on getting back. So there's a lot of changes to the Falcon architecture, but they still are some time off from that particular moment in time.
Yeah. And, you know, a good way to think about this, right? Musk loves to use the airline architecture, right? That we need to start thinking of rockets as airplanes, which certainly at the beginning of our conversation with BFR is foremost on their minds. But I mean, let's to really put this in context, right? If for anyone listening who's flown Delta or American or, you know, particularly Allegiant Air, right? Allegiant Air's entire fleet is the MD-88 aircraft, right? Delta uses the MD-88 for a lot of their regional short hop flights and everything like that. The last MD-88 was built and delivered in June of 1997. Literally over 20 years ago is when they stopped producing that variant, right? They're still one of the most popular aircraft in domestic air travel.
Right, and 97 was the last one built, not all of the ones that you're flying.
Not all of them. Exactly. Right.
The ones you're flying are well before that.
So your comment, right, that this is a shift away from production to fleet management is exactly what this is, right? And if you have 40 to 50, right, let's just use that. I don't know how many they're going to end up having when this is all said and done. But if you've got 40 to 50 Falcon 9 cores sitting there, and each one can be used 100 times, and you've got the refurbishment time on these things down to, even if they only get the refurbishment down to 3 to 4 months, right, you're not flying 40 to 50 missions in 3 months. Right.
Yeah, you got a whole fleet turnover every couple of months, you know, if you've got your launch rate up to Elon Musk levels.
Exactly. So it becomes fleet management instead of production. And like Musk said, this goes back to your point about, like, when he opened the conversation saying we figured out how to pay for it, right? Figuring out how to pay for it was shutting down the Falcon 9 production line.
Right.
And starting to shift and try to convince customers, like, look, you can go on a Falcon 9, or total number off the top of my head here, or 10 of you who all need to go to low Earth orbit at this inclination can just ride share on a BFR for less than what it would cost to put you individually on a Falcon 9 or a Falcon Heavy, right? And therefore the business model begins to shift, but the millions of dollars you're spending on production of the Falcon 9s then becomes millions of dollars you spend on production of BFR.
Right, and you still have a business model of launching satellites with Falcon 9 and Falcon Heavy, for that matter, that, you know, you don't shut down production and the business model goes away. That does stick around for a while if they can pull off a fleet management type of mindset with this. And then the other part that comes with that, I was thinking about their infrastructure at the Cape and at Hawthorne and all of that kind of stuff. If they're going to shift their, you know, they're going to shift production of BFR to Hawthorne rather than what previously was thought to be on-site manufacturing, that means that all of the Falcon hardware that they use out in Hawthorne is going to move out, and they have a lot of buildings down at the Cape now that they're either taking over or building for management of Falcon 9 cores and refurbishment of Falcon 9 cores. So if they just move, you know, Falcon 9 production and refurbishment to these facilities at the Cape, maybe that's the point when they were like, well, what do we do with Hawthorne at that point? We've got empty buildings over here. We're already getting close to that point when a lot of this work is happening at the Cape, because this booster that's about to fly the next mission never left Florida when it landed. It was refurbished entirely in Florida, right?
Refurbished entirely in Florida, but then taken to McGregor for...
it was fired.
Test stand. Yes.
But even that's, you know... That's incredible in its own right, that the refurbishment, I don't know how much they had to do or how little they had to do of this particular one, but all that happened in Florida already. So you do have
which
that
is
shift
an important
of
note.
Facility infrastructure.
Yeah, which is an important note. And if it did, I missed it. So fair game on that if I'm wrong on this. But I don't actually believe they ever took a Falcon 9 core back to Hawthorne for the refurbishment. I believe... of the ones that landed back in Florida or were East Coast launches and came back on the barge, I believe all of those were refurbished at the Cape.
Or at least refurbished to still be a Falcon 9.
Right. I mean, maybe components were taken back for various things, but I don't believe any of the Florida launched cores routed through Hawthorne for refurbishment. So we're already doing all of the refurbishment of the Falcon.
Just happens to be a couple of cores this year, not 40 to 50, like you're saying.
Right, not 40 or 50. But, you know, there are, I mean, so we've recovered two cores thus far off the West Coast. The first one being the Iridium launch in January, and then the Iridium launch, or no, three. We've done three, because Foremost Sat landed two. So three. So, but we already know that the first Iridium core is at Cape, is at the Cape, right? So you're talking about 13 of the 16 recovered cores were East Coast launches. So that means, you know, a vast majority of them are at the Cape and, you know, are just in that little assembly line of refurbishment. Right. Yeah.
So the last thing we should maybe get into is some of the strategical side of this, maybe the talk about ISS, the talk about these lunar bases, and how this maybe interplays with NASA's plans for the foreseeable future. A lot of talk has been had this past year about Elon opening his mouth about moon bases and things like that, just as the political winds seem to be shifting towards moon bases or anything like that. We've had Blue Origin time and time again talk about how they would be willing to work with NASA on a lander that could back off of something like the Deep Space Gateway. We've had JAXA and Russia now. A lot of the international agencies, ESA, obviously, they've been big on the moon village idea. Everybody seems to be looking towards the moon, and you have these two, you know, Blue Origin and SpaceX, and even a little bit of these other companies like Lockheed, offering up plans to be used as part of this architecture. So in that way, how would you see these two paths running in that BFR development is happening, whether or not they get Deep Space Gateway contracts, whether or not Deep Space Gateway happens at all? How do you think that kind of interplay works, that there's this as yet unfunded government project that's going on that SpaceX would hope to contribute to, but SpaceX is kind of pushing forward on their own plans? Do you think that's going to rub people the wrong way, that they are saying, hey, we'll be there, we'll see you over at the moon if you get around to it, but otherwise, have a good day? Or do you think that, you know, there is some sort of synergy, for lack of a better non-corporate-y term, for these two plans riding along together?
I think the answer to your question is both. I think it's definitely going to rub certain people the wrong way, right? There's definitely going to be the sect of people out there who say, oh, well, if BFR just does the lunar aspect, right, which was not a huge part of the presentation, it was really just a, hey, if it can go to Mars, it can go to the moon, and here's how. You know, that's definitely going to rub people the wrong way. There are definitely going to be people, and when I say people, I'm not talking about NASA. I'm not talking about as a collective, right? I'm talking about, you know, just people in general, right? Who that's going to rub the wrong way. And they're going to say, well, so BFR is designed to kill SLS. It's designed to kill the Deep Space Gateway, you know, this, that, the other. It's important to note that NASA does not view BFR as an SLS killing, you know, machine. They very much view it as another part of an architecture that will do something different than what Deep Space Gateway is proposing. You know, we saw in the presentation, you know, it was BFR on the surface of the moon. It was a moon base. It was a, you know, it was a colony, a permanent, well, maybe not permanent. I'm saying permanent because if we're going to do a permanent Mars colony, I can't see how the proposed, you know, moon base Alpha is not permanent. You know, that's not what Deep Space Gateway is doing, right? Deep Space Gateway is offering a space station in cislunar space in one of the Lagrangian points. And that's a different architecture. That's a different feel. It's a different mission than what the moon offers you, especially if you're looking for microgravity instead of 1/6 gravity. So there's definitely a way that this could be a synergy. You know, we need to see exactly what Deep Space Gateway becomes. You know, you are right. There is no official funding line for Deep Space Gateway right now. It's funding is coming from the, you know, sort of, not theoretical, but, you know, they're the what if studies about what could the architecture look like, the requests for information on, hey, if we do this, what could you give us, right? And how could we use existing technology? Because you look at some of the renderings for Deep Space Gateway, right? And you can almost immediately go, that's a Cygnus spacecraft, you know, structure.
Boeing's got that part. Lockheed's got that part.
Yeah. Exactly. That's a former multipurpose logistics module that we used for the station, right? You can see how, you know, that the station architecture is very much a part of Deep Space Gateway.
So much so that the roadmap has just Falcon 9s in them, like, you know, logos stripped and all, as like, oh, hypothetical commercial resupply.
And that's a good point, right? Is that the plans that we have seen for Deep Space Gateway are not that SLS does it all. Right, it's that there is a commercial synergy here. So, you know, a lot of it is going to end up shaking out in what does BFR become? What are its actual capabilities? Right, how much can it lift to LEO and GEO and the moon? And, you know, there is a question that needs to be answered of, is it the most optimal vehicle for cislunar, you know, in terms of building the gateway structure, or building structures there. It might turn out that New Glenn is better suited for that. It might turn out that Ariane 6, you know, or SLS is the best vehicle for what we want to do. But, you know, as with everything, what we want to do will be incredibly complicated with Deep Space Gateway by what the government wishes to do.
Yeah. Politics and rocketry are quite really different.
Exactly. So I don't personally see BFR as the, well, this is the rocket, so everything else is obsolete in this goal. I think more so than anything, what rocket flight has taught us time and time and time and time again is you never just have one system that does it all.
Yeah, and that's actually one of my concerns, though, is that, you know, well, I shouldn't say one of my concerns, but there's a lot of hay made about how part of the shuttle's ultimate downfall was that its potential was sold as it can do everything. Right. And that was kind of that spreading of, you know, it spread itself too thin in some ways politically. And there has been some, you know, talk about, is BFR doing the same thing? Is it spreading itself too thin by saying we can do point-to-point travel, we can do lunar, we can do Mars, right, we can do LEO, we can do GEO. It can do everything. Is it going to fall down that same, you know, same pitfall?
An excellent question. I laugh somewhat nervously because, you know, yes, shuttle was billed in the 70s and the early 80s as the vehicle that could do it all, right? And do it all in terms of like LEO, low Earth orbit, geostationary orbit launches, and interplanetary mission launches, and national defense, and all that. I mean, it certainly did all of those things.
Right. Yeah. That's not to say that it didn't.
So
right.
it to me, it wasn't a matter of shuttle not living up to the promise that it could do the physical things that we wanted it to do. It did all of those things, up to and including building the space station. Where shuttle fell was in the price and the price point and the sheer amount of time because of how complex the vehicle was to turn it around. You know, you look at, you know, just before the Challenger accident, you know, that Atlantis holds the record for turnaround of 26 days in the processing facility. I mean, that's basically you opened up the payload bay, you reconfigured it, you swapped out the engines, and back to the VAB you went to, you know, to be mated. And we very quickly realized that there was absolutely no way that that was going to happen. And from that point on, it was between 80 to 90 days minimum processing time. So, you know, I think more so when we talk about shuttles, you know, failings, that's more where it fell down instead of spreading itself too thin. Now, will that price point for BFR hold, or will we see a repeat of that? I don't know. I don't think so. I think, you know, we see the Falcons launching at a brand new sticker price, you know, in the $60 million range, which is already close to $60 million cheaper than, you know, than you know, some of the next alternatives out there. You know, SpaceX has said, while they haven't disclosed a dollar figure, that all of the people, all the three customer, well, two customers, because one will have flown twice with SES, have received reduced rates for the reused Falcon 9. So, you know, lowering the cost by reuse is certainly coming. We, you know, they seem to be on track to meet that stated goal, which is something that Shuttle could never do. So maybe not.
Yeah, I think that was kind of one of the things, though, that people conflate ability and ability in economics and politics, which are distinct segments that make up what a launch vehicle is, what good a launch vehicle can do. And those all have different arguments for Shuttle, for BFR, for New Glenn, even, which is why I think, you know, this is something that even last year we were talking about this. A lot of these questions about will this launch vehicle kill that launch vehicle, that stuff's going to be decided not on the pad, but in the years following when that thing hits the pad. You know, I don't think much changes today because of what we heard last week from Elon Musk. But 2020, the year that all new launch vehicles are and shall ever launch, that will be a very interesting year.
It will be. And you know, that point too of, you know, BFR will not replace everything that we have, right? Because, I mean, even if you look at it now, right, where, I mean, Falcon 9 has certainly cornered a significant chunk of the launch market. I was looking at these at this the other day based on the number of launches that we have left worldwide this year. I mean, Falcon 9 alone, if everything holds, will account for 25% of the total number of orbital launches performed. I mean, that is insane, right? That one rocket will have done that much. But, you know, there's a reality that, you know, Falcon 9 can do many things. Falcon Heavy will hopefully be able to do many things. But there are things that the Atlas V can do, places it can get us, that Falcon 9 can't do. That Falcon Heavy can, but we don't have Falcon Heavy yet, right? So, but again, it goes back to not wanting to have one particular and single architecture to do it all. SpaceX seems to be great at recovering from, you know, when they recovered from CRS-7 and AMO-6 in what seemed like a mind-bogglingly short amount of time. But it's rocketry.
Yeah. There's always a lot of variables at play, so.
Yeah.
Well, I can't think of a much better spot to end it. You got any last-minute thoughts on BFR or anything else that we heard about?
Yeah, you know, I think for me personally, right, when I was listening to the presentation, right, there was a huge element of hope and inspiration and ambition that is wrapped up in this. And, you know, there are very few presentations that I personally would stay up in the middle of the night for. and that was definitely one of them. And, you know, thinking about how our mindsets have changed about space, right? How especially in the US, right, where we went through that slump after Shuttle, and watching SLS's development and watching Falcon's development, and, you know, certainly being excited when new rocket systems, you know, come online, the power of the presentation and what we're talking about with Mars colonization is, I mean, let's not forget that the prime thing here is we are talking about a human colonization effort on Mars within the decade, right? Even if you miss the 2024 right window, which is when the first two BFRs to carry people are supposed to go to Mars, even if you miss that by 2 years and you have to wait to the 2026 window, that's 9 years. Like, we're talking about doing this in less than a decade. Do we have a shot at doing that? Yeah. Is it possible we might miss it by a few years? Also, yes. but that ambition, right, and that drive of saying, we don't discount the technical risks. We don't discount that this is technically challenging. Of course it is. But, you know, today being the 60th anniversary of the Sputnik launch, right? that was incredibly ambitious. That was incredibly challenging, right? But no one stopped to say, well, it's that, so we're just not going to do it, or we're going to go slower than we think we need. We're going to take the risk. We're going to do it as safely as we can. But if we've got the technology, why not try? And that drive and that ambition, you know, is what lies at the heart of space exploration. And I think for me personally, and I'm sure for a lot of others, that's what makes this so exciting, is to be talking about not an, well, if in my lifetime we get to Mars, right? To say, no, like in my lifetime, when we try this, that's it. It's that desire to continue to push forward. And that's what this is all about.
Chris, I don't even want to say anything to finish the podcast after that, because that is it. And that is, you know, I don't know, that's perfectly conveyed for what I think a lot of us that are looking at this presentation, you're right, staying up in the middle of the night, looking at all this stuff, being excited about it. Yeah, there are schedule questions. Yeah, there are technical questions, but nobody ever said there weren't. That wasn't part of his presentation. The first slide was not like, now, if you discount the technical and schedule considerations for the next 10 years, here's our plan. It's, you know, it comes with that. And I think a lot of times that is lost when you're looking at something as grand of an ambition that way. So I agree with just about everything you said there. And it's good to be excited about this stuff in general. And I feel sorry for people that limit themselves by not getting excited about it in some way whatsoever. And for those people, go to Florida and watch a rocket launch.
Yes, definitely.
All right, Chris, everyone can find him on Twitter. I will have a link to your Twitter account in the show notes. Everyone has, I assume people that are listening to this have read NASASpaceflight.com with the amount of times that I've linked over to you guys at the website there. But if not, check it out. Some of the best writing out there on the web regarding spaceflight. Is there anything else that you would like to point people to?
Not really. I would just say thank you for having me on. It was great to be here. I'm a fan of the podcast, so it was nice to be a part of it.
It's great to have the Elon Musk ordained detail man come on and talk and hear from you. And I like doing these shows because I like hearing from people that I only read tweets by or read articles by. It's always good to hang out, even if we're not actually face to face. We're at least looking at some pixels of each other and talking about this stuff. So hopefully we meet up at
Enabled
some point.
Enabled by space and satellites.
Exactly, there it is. Yeah, yeah, right. Thank you very much, Chris, for coming on the show.
Thank you for having me.
Thanks again to Chris for coming on the show, and thank you so much for being here with us this week to break down all of the SpaceX news. And before I get out of here, I want to say a huge thank you to all of the supporters of Manage and Cutoff over on Patreon. There are 102 of you over there. We've broken into triple digits now. I'm so thankful for all of your support. And this particular episode was produced by 20 executive producers: Chris, Mike, Pat, Matt, George, Brad, Ryan, Jameson, Guinevere, Nadim, Peter, Donald, Lee, Jasper, Chris, and 5 anonymous executive producers. You make this show possible week in and week out, and I am so thankful for your support and everyone else over at patreon.com/Miko. And don't forget, if you're over there and you pledged $3 or more a month, you get access to the Miko Headlines Show. Each and every Friday, I break down the headlines of the week. And we added a new perk this past week. If you're giving $5 or more a month to the Patreon, you get access to the Miko Discord, which is a chat room to kind of hang out, make some new friends, talk about space stuff. And we had a little live event there last week for the Elon Musk talk, and it was a good time hanging out with a small group of people that are always fun to talk with. So if you are on Patreon, or if you would like access to any of those perks, head over to patreon.com/Miko and do it there. Thank you so much for listening, and I will talk to you next week.